Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, we cut off the bumper music because this man is so great. We have to bring him in immediately. We've reached out into the bowels of the pits of the earth, and we've found the secret hiding location of he himself, the man who brings us great film on the mafia. Yes, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, we bring you the one, the only, Dennis Blue Eyes Moore, also known as the big bopper of hammers of filmmaking. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Wayne?
Don't kill me.
I'm doing really well here. So, thanks for having me on the show. And I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I've been working in film in Toronto for the last, I guess, 15 years now. And I make documentaries primarily. And they're arts and culture documentaries. So they're kind of a different take than on the big budget, you know, A&E type of crime documentaries. And recently, like anyone else, I've kind of shifted a little bit to more crime-related material. New film coming out as well after this one. So to me, I just kind of find it interesting, not so much about the crime, but a kind of the world around it. And this film, The Ravenite, started from a short story I read about 15 years ago in a great publication that was devoted to photography and documentary and writing. And it's by a writer from The New Yorker and author Alec Wilkinson. And I just kind of found it a bit humorous and a bit strange. And it was a story from the perspective of a young writer who came to New York to start his career. And his first apartment happened to be across the street from the Ravenite Social Club. So it was a view from his windows into the kind of ongoing, sometimes mundane world of what it was like to just live in that neighborhood in Little Italy.
For people who may not know, what was the Ravenite Social Club?
Well, again, it was originally... There's different theories about, you know, back into history of where it came from. And some say it was actually the same location that Lucky Luciano used. But there's no definite proof. And it was never called the Ravenite. At one point, the other theory is that it was taken over in the 70s by Neil Della Croce, and he named it the Ravenite after the Poe poem because his girlfriend liked it. That's the theory, the Raven. And again, you know, there's no proof or anything, but it sounds plausible enough, and it was just one of the social clubs on the street. However, it had cachet because it was a Gambino family's headquarters. And actually, our story isn't so much about Gotti. He came later after the writer was moving out of the street. It is kind of about the, I would say, 70, takes place from 79 to 92, but it is during the rise and fall of, you know, the height of John Gotti and the Gambino family. But when he moved in, you know, it was still kind of a low key club. You know, it wasn't until Gotti moved in that it became bricked up and it became this, you know, shrine as it is today. So anyway, we're delving into a little bit of the history, but it really is from the perspective of a few key neighbors in the neighborhood, and it's anecdotal and it is on the side of comedy. It's a very lighthearted approach. We're not going to get into the crimes or any alleged activities necessarily. It's kind of this quirky story, you know, a short film, a short story type of format.
Oh, interesting that. Okay. I have to ask, can you recite some of the things that he observed from his apartment?
Yeah, one of the things that always kind of struck me about reading the story was... One, it's just kind of funny that when he moved to the neighborhood, you know, he didn't even think these guys across the street were in the mafia. He didn't think they had, like, the intelligence to be in the mafia. Like, he was observing these kind of low-level guys, you know, who would wash cars and talk tough and just kind of hang out this club all day long, right? I mean, he did see the bigwigs come in for meetings, and they were a different style, you know, nice limousines, well-dressed, that type of thing. And but he still didn't believe, you know, he just thought this can't be, like, you know, because the spin is that, you know, the mafia movies like The Godfather and that kind of thing really was in the people's mind. This is what the mafia is. These well-dressed, you know, businessmen type, not these low-level guys with T-shirts and, you know, kind of very schlubbish kind of guys hanging out all day just doing nothing. So there was a contrast between, you know, what Hollywood was portraying and what real life was. Now, having said that, I mean, if you go back to the 30s and 40s, the styles of these guys were, you know, they were the first kind of media stars like Capone and stuff like that. So they were rich and well-dressed, and they did have like a following in the papers and fans. So I think, and in fact, I think that's what's kind of interesting and cool about Gotti is that he kind of brought that old style back, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, talking about in the day versus now, how do I say this politely? It'd be nice if my local thugs had that style. You know, I'd be more forgiving of them. I mean, the kids I see sling the flash, and the corners are rude and obnoxious. They tend to be in people weaker than they are. People that I think, perhaps incorrectly, that if the real mafia showed up for 5 seconds, wouldn't be in that corner anymore because they would not be tolerated.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, the other aspect of the film is, you know, obviously a little bit of background and history of the club, but it is really a change in the neighborhood. The tagline of the film is, there is no such thing as a mafia. And that comes from a line that the writer actually experienced that he got from the local cops at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a play on the fact that if you go down to Little Italy today, it's happening all over the world, right? Like, you know, the gentrification, the change in the neighborhood, even though the old days are gone and may have been, you know, more of a rougher New York, people seem to kind of prefer that over the squeaky clean kind of tourist traps that some of these neighborhoods have become. You know, there's still a lot of original things down there in any city, but I think there's an overtone about the change in a neighborhood as well. So,
sure.
We're not trying to cover everything, but it's a quirky little story from a different perspective. And so we have about 5 people, main characters in the film. One fellow, he's lived there since 1967, so he pretty much across from the church and beside the club, so he has a lot of interesting anecdotes. The writer himself, the filmmaker Jim Jarmusch, who lived there for a time and who does mafia-related films, or he has, who's interested in kind of the culture. And then a few others. So to me, the other aspect of it is that what we have in the film, our main character is the owner of the shoe store that used to be the Ravenite. And of course, the shoe store signifies, you know, kind of the ultimate gentrification of something. What could be more opposite than what that club was? And now it's this high-end shoe store. It's pretty funny to me. That's like a punchline, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let me ask you this. Where can we watch your film at? Since obviously everybody who listens to the show will want to buy a copy, how do we do that?
So what's happening now is that we went out. We have a great team. There's myself and co-director Morgan Schmidtfang from California, and we have like my co-creator and producer art director Dan Kremen here from Toronto, and another great producer Katie Swales, and we have a great editor Will Nold, and so we put together a lot of filmmaking friends and are trying this kind of new experiment because we're doing this completely independent. And so we're putting in our own time and money, and we've actually shot 90% of the film. So now we're in the post-production stage. So we're hoping to have something, you know, in the spring for festivals and then go from there. So I would guess next summer we should have something.
Okay.
And then, you know, we would put it into festivals and then try to get it onto digital channels, that type of thing.
Okay, let me ask you this question. So are you seeking funding via, let's say, a Kickstarter or something to help you finish the film?
Well, yes, to plug the film, we certainly are. We are on Indiegogo, and we launched 3 days ago. And we have an ambitious goal of $25,000, and that would just cover the cost to pay basically our editor and the expensive license fees for all the photography we want to use. So that would be the bare minimum we need to complete the film. And then we'll go from there. But right now, like, I mean, it's come together for something that's hasn't been funded, and everybody is like terrific, and we're all having a blast, and we're making new friends, and we'll all be friends and filmmaking friends into the future because of this project. So that's what we get out of it immediately.
Well, absolutely. I can't tell you the number of great people I've met working in media. Absolutely, and they're your friends forever, it seems, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's why I get off on it. You know, you travel, you meet new people, you so much of it is the fallout from making a film, you know, all the people, great people you meet and characters and kind of relationships you build for the future, right? So I kind of, that's half the reason I do it.
Absolutely. But so if somebody listening to the show wants to, say, kick in $5 or $10 because they want to see this film gets made, they can find you on Indiegogo?
On Indiegogo, yeah. So we're actually on Indiegogo called The Ravenite Documentary. So if they want to Google us, check out our Facebook page, join that group. You know, you'll get updates and you'll get information. Contribute what you can. Our offerings are pretty cool, and I'm just going to scroll through them here. So,
please.
You know, we have different levels, and the film credits and doc downloads is great. You'll get a copy of the film. The Manhattan Mafia Guide as an ebook for Kindle is fantastic. It's written by our friend and historian and mafia expert Eric Ferreira, who goes back three generations in that neighborhood, Lower East Side, and he's a great historian, so you should check out his site, Lower East Side History Project. We're also giving away a tour or two of his mafia tour in the neighborhood. He's featured in the film. Yeah, and we also have some other mafia ebooks from a great supporter and friend, Arthur Nash, who is another great historian on this and who wrote the book Gangland, How the FBI... he wrote New York City Gangland, The Images of America, fantastic book. And Howard Blum, who wrote one of the original books during the time when Gotti was taken down, Gangland, How the FBI Broke the Mob. It's terrific. So we have books like that. We have the Mafia Tour and the shoe store that used to be the Ravenite. We're giving away gift certificates for that. And there's all sorts of great items in there, from high-end shoes to designer bags to wallets, all sorts of great handmade leather goods. So we've got quirky offerings from the people in the film. And then if you don't mind, one more, the fellow I mentioned who's lived there his whole life, in this beautiful house across from the church, is a New York psychic, quite famous, and Frank Andrews, who has a lot of great, funny stories. And so we've got about four unclaimed personal psychic readings for him as well. So
I'd love to have a personal
scan the
psychic
page.
Reading.
Yeah, so scan the page and look us up and join the Facebook page. We're on Twitter, too, just trying to garner new followers, and we're also on Instagram, so everything's all there on the Indiegogo site. Check it out, and check out the Facebook page as well, and there'll be film release information and how it's going. So that's my plug.
No, that's great. Thank you. I mean, we brought you on to plug your film, and I want people to know about all the interesting films out there, because I like The Godfather, I like The Goodfellas, I like Casino, I like those films. I also want to see the non-Hollywood films, more like what it was really like versus what we're told it was like?
Yeah, I think there's a kind of zeitgeist in the air about two things now. The, you know, 80s New York has become very popular, and people kind of dipping back into the past and saying it was such a great time, the grittiness of New York, and there's lots of media and shows and articles and photography that's coming out about that. We've tap into a little bit of that because it takes place into that. And again, like I said, we're not a history lesson. We're not a big budget A&E expose on the club. We're kind of this quirky little lighthearted approach that I don't think anybody's done yet. We found characters who lived across the street and they tell us interesting stories. Some of the stories you mentioned earlier, anecdotes, one came back to me that's in Alex's original article, kind of cracked me up because I've never seen that in a mob movie, and it sounds like something that would be a great scene from, you know, any mob movie. And it was the fact that he said when the media would swarm like the Ravenite trying to get a quote from somebody inside about whatever trial was coming up or hit or whatever, the mob guys would pay the street kids who were on their side to come out and bang garbage can lids every time a reporter tried to you know, do a story or ask a question. And to me, that I would love to somehow convey that in our film, because I've never seen anything like that in a mob film, and it sounds like something out of a Scorsese movie, you know. So there's little anecdotes like that that come out that I find very interesting.
Very much so. I mean, the real history I find always better than the faker Hollywood histories, because to me, in my opinion, the more real information I have, I can make decisions based on that versus being fed what the media wants me to believe. Does that make any sense?
Oh, that makes perfect sense. I mean, my interest in as a documentary filmmaker is, yeah, I mean, whatever, it is about truth in a way, but you still got to knit together, you know, an entertaining, informative, whatever story. And
right.
So my background, I'm always interested in literary journalism, because you can go out and do perfect journalistic piece for a newspaper, but a literary journalistic piece takes it to the next level, like a documentary, where you got to write a story but still kind of knit the characters together, play a little bit with the timeline, but it is all truth, right? Fact-based, but it's not written as a factual piece, it's written as a creative piece. So to me, a little documentary like this is almost like a short story, you know, and it's from a perspective that offers up a different perspective than what, you know, we've been taught or told in a bigger budget film that really needs to rely on strong characters, stories, and dialogue. So that's kind of where we're going with it. So it is a big experiment, but it, you know, we'll see what comes out at the other end. But right now, we've got a lot of unique things. For example, the owner of Sidewalk Shoes, where the Ravenite was, she's totally aware, Layla May, and one of the great characters, of the, you know, history of the place. She's not interested in the mafia necessarily, but of course she can't ignore it, because fans come from all over the world to come into this hallowed ground, right? They want to see the place. They want to, the floor is still original, so that's about the only original aspect of it. But I mean, the apartment upstairs where they did the taping, you know, they just renovated that. The building's the same. The light pole where they bugged, you know, the club is still the same light pole. You know, the neighborhood is gentrified, but, you know, there's still original characters down there. It's still original restaurants, for example. But what's interesting about the owner of the shoe store, she also came to New York like everyone else, starting a new life. And so she lived there and knew, she lived on the street and knew that club when it was the club, and remembers seeing the mobsters hanging out there. So she has a double kind of role as an observer from the time, but now she owns this famous site. So there's things like that that come out when we turn on the cameras and just walk around and start filming, right? It's
sure.
Like, wow, we didn't know that there was that kind of depth, right?
I mean, again, just talking about that apartment that's been renovated, I mean, will someone potentially pay a higher price to live there because it has that history attached to it?
I don't think so. I mean, well, put it this way, New York, everyone's going to pay a high price for you know, renting or buying. But I, you know, some of the anecdotes that you told us, you know, I guess somebody would if they wanted to, but it's still kind of a building, you know what I mean? Like people pay for, I guess, famous people's apartments, but they don't always sell for that, but maybe this one will. In fact, what's kind of funny about it, if you watch the teaser we have online for the film, at the end we've included a clip of the ceiling falling down while we were shooting the interview with her in the shoe store. And it was kind of funny because it's like the ghost of, you know, the Gambino is like dropping the ceiling on us while we're filming to tell us to get out. Or what was really happening is that they were renovating that apartment that day while we were filming. So two things that occurred to me is that, wow, that apartment is no longer the apartment, you know, that would be famous for, you know, the old woman where they held the meetings and bugged Gotti and his associates that eventually brought him down. And two, it's changing like the neighborhood and gentrification. It's being renovated and kind of like washed clean. So there wouldn't be much to see. We asked to go up there and there really wasn't anything to see other than drywall, you know?
Right. I understand what you're saying completely. I find it fascinating too. And I'm a big conspiracy fan theory. It'd be fascinating to find out with all the gentrification. We knew of the mafia and their activities back in the day, right? And
right.
If New York is anything like Milwaukee, we have a lot of gentrification coming in this area. And it's always interesting to see how the best efforts of the city of Milwaukee are funding people doing the most despicable things in the name of gentrification. And who was worse?
Right.
Did Gotti do bad things? Absolutely. Is somebody, say, taking money meant for the poor and put it in their pocket and not get caught, is they doing equally bad things? My answer most likely would be yes. You know, the names might change.
Absolutely. I mean, like, I don't think it's of the scope of, like, some of the, you know, evils that go on today with big banks, you know, and I don't want to go down and make it a big political thing, but, you know, gosh, you're not telling me that Enron back in its day wasn't a bunch of thugs, you know, controlling power? But that's, like, worse than, like, anything else. Anyway, the fact is these guys also contributed to a neighborhood and schools and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yes, they did heinous things, and that's part of it, but I – you know, you look back now and it doesn't seem as on the scope of what you see nowadays. I'm not saying that, you know, two wrongs make a right, but I don't know. Like, you know, the other thing is I find it interesting that the people back then, for example, in Little Italy and when the club was running, that here you have one of the most dangerous cities in the world. It's certainly in North America at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here's the safest neighborhood in the street, like the safest street in New York, you know, or probably in North America at the time. You know, these guys didn't let stuff go on. Now, I'm not condoning, you know, activities outside of that they would be running. But, you know, maybe that's part of culture. When I did my previous film, Mugshot, it was we had to delve into a little bit about, you know, crime and history, of course. And one of the scholars who's also in this film and great writer, Luke Son, he brought up the fact that, you know, and a few other people, the fact that without crime, you have no history of any culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought that was kind of, you know, funny and true. And if you look back, ancient Rome all the way up, like all big civilizations, it's just part of how things are done in a way, right? I mean, where I grew up in Windsor and Detroit, probably similar to Milwaukee, you know, I don't think you can extricate one kind of business from crime, especially on a high level of building cities and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, look,
so I'm not, we're not making any statement. Yeah,
we're
not making any big statements, but we're just kind of telling this interesting story, and the undertones of that could be there.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, people here, as we just talked, us a little bit off there, is that, I know we started the show that way, is my idea of the mafia, and I'm probably way off base, is around the mafia also's home, you didn't find drug dealers slinging hash because it wasn't going to be tolerated. You didn't find employees being beat up in street corners. It would not be tolerated. And when you have people in my plaque tell me that they wish, because they know I do the Milwaukee mob, right? So they wish that we had somebody like this today, because that tells me they no longer trust the city to provide that level of protection.
Right. Well, I think that's true. But at the same time, remember, like, a lot of the mafia is doing that for the optics, and they're controlling the drug scene. So, but they're also in cahoots with local law enforcement and whatnot.
Yep.
It's a tangled web. Again, you examine any kind of culture, civilization throughout history, especially the greater ones like America or Rome or whatever. You know, I'm sure, like, you know, ancient cultures, you've got people in everybody's kind of back pocket, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
you
can spend your life kind of examining it all. But again, to me, I find that looking back 25, 30 years into this street compared to what it is today, just fascinating in the sense that if you told, like, you know, a 25-year-old who's down there today what it was like back then, and even it's a little bit beyond my scope, I was younger back then, I remember reading about the stuff in the papers, and New York was a dastardly place to visit. But if you would tell people that and show them pictures, I don't think they would believe you that it wasn't that long ago that this was turned on its head, you know? And so that's another aspect of it is there's change. And so the tagline, like I said, there is no such thing as a mafia, is a double entendre where it's like there is and there isn't. After Gotti was, you know, taken down, they kind of moved away, went on, back into the shadows again, and pretty much moved away from Manhattan. So it's not what – they're still there, but it's not what it once was, you know? And no. So that's kind of the play on it. And you, what you see now is, you know, condos and expensive real estate and coffee shops and like gentrification, like you see in any city. So I think it's just an interesting little kind of take on that aspect of New York and that neighborhood.
And I think it's great that you do this because, as I found doing the Milwaukee Mob, is people mm-hmm. born in the 80s or 90s who are now, what, 30 and 40, have no idea the city of Milwaukee had its own little mafia for quite some time. No clue.
Right.
And
yeah, Detroit,
we lose our
the
history,
same way.
We lose part of us. What, sir?
Yeah, Detroit, you know, where I grew up, the same thing. I mean, every city's got it. Now, here
yeah.
up in Canada, you see, believe it or not, I mean, a lot of these guys moved up here. And you don't see the activity as optically as you once did back then, as we were saying in the 80s, as you did in America. You'd see it in the papers, like, you know, fairly regularly. And it's kind of faded away, or it's moved away off, you know, to New Jersey and places like that. However, you know, up here in Canada, a lot of these guys from New York, families kind of settled up in Toronto and in the suburbs and in Montreal, you see it every other day now. There's some kind of, you know, mafia wars going on up there. So
yep.
it's kind of interesting that we're doing this film from Canada mm-hmm. and from California, yet there isn't like the kind of activity there once was in New York that you even see
right.
up here now.
All right. So,
but again, we're not making a mafia story as much as we are making kind of a, it's a centerpiece of the story, but it's from the perspective of people that, you know, some people that just kind of live down there. So, it, you know, I interview a friend of mine who is a mafia, once was a mobster and now is an informant. And so we interview him, but he goes back into the 50s. He was Jimmy Hoffa's driver when he started
oh, wow.
out. So he's got an interesting take on New York in that time.
Sure. With only a couple minutes left to go, sir, where do we find
yep.
you again online? Your website and your Twitter handle, if you could, sir?
Yeah, and the Facebook page, and that's where you can find us there. So, yeah, I think it's going to be like an interesting experiment, a little film, and it'll bring you history from a different perspective, but at the same time, you kind of get to meet the people. I forgot to plug the fact that, you know, the film is filled with like a lot of great photographs and rare photography from the time. And so you'll be able to get a sense of that and meet a lot of different people that live there and saw what they saw. So without giving away too much, we're trying to figure out exactly the best way to put this together. But every, you know, dollar helps to get this finished. And I think people have an entertaining little film that we can distribute around North America, you know, and hopefully get on something like Netflix.
Oh, and we might be able to help you with that one, but that's a conversation for another time. But I want to thank
right.
you so much for being on the show, sir. I'll bring you on again for your other show, Mug Chats, next week or so. I'd like to do that as well. But with that,
yeah, that would
let
be great.
Let you go, and thank you for your time and your generosity of being on the show, in the upcoming show as well.
Yeah,
sir.
Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, bye.
Okay, bye.
Wasn't a nice show. Yes, I was told that Dennis Blue Eyes Moore would be a hard interview. That if you did anything to piss him off, my house would be blown up by now. And so far, my house has been blown up. Oh, it must have been a good interview, which I thank him for. But please check out his site. Go to the Facebook page. Check him out on his Indiegogo page. And if you can help him out with a couple of bucks, I think it would be an investment well worthwhile. Anyway, if you'd like to talk to me about any subject at all, the best way to do that is my email, which would be themilwaukeemob@gmail.com. And with that, thank you very much for everybody for listening. We look forward to even more guests and the like. And we'll let everybody have a great day and watch out because they are out to get you. Bye-bye.